Blog Talk Radio.
Bonjour, mes amis. Comment ça va? Darlings, I hope we're all ça va bien tonight. This is Sybil Brunchen coming to you live high atop the Chrysler Building from the revolving ballroom of the Café Berlin in the heart of New York City. And yes, it's true, Mummy is back in her hometown for a second week in a row after all these months of broadcasting to you from all these different locations. I'm here in the studio with my wonderful producer, Gwendolyn Holdenberry. Gwendolyn, you're on the alternate mic over in the sound booth, aren't you?
Yes, I am, Mommy.
And we're here with our switchboard of operators. By the way, I want to encourage you from the top of the show. So many of you are lagabeds, or whatever you want to call them. What did my grandmother used to call people who stayed in bed? Lazabeds. Yes, Sybil Brunchen, come down. Lazabed, you're a lazabed. You can call in. I'm going to tell you the phone number at the top of the show before I say anything else, because Gwendolyn and I always get hit with an avalanche of phone calls in the last 10 minutes of the show. The number is 323-784-9639. That's 323-784-9639. I wish it was an acronym of some sort, or I wish it spelled something, but it doesn't. I've tried for hours on the phone dial. It doesn't spell anything interesting. I wish it spelled Butt Poke, Idaho, or Pocahontas, or something strange like that, but it doesn't. It's just a dumb old number. The only good thing about it is there are no zeros in it. But try, you know something, this will be a fun child activity for everyone at home. When the show is done, get a pen and paper, write down your phone number, and then check to see what the letters are that correspond to your phone number, because people don't realize that sometimes their phone numbers spell out funny words. And I often put them in my stories on Facebook. Please call the nice man, we'll tell you how to order. And the phone numbers often spell funny things. So try it with your own phone number and see if your phone number spells something intriguing that makes it easy to remember, especially as you get older and the Alzheimer's take over. You can't remember your phone number, but you might remember what it spells when the nice ambulance people come to pick you up and take you away. All right, now, this is Come Now, Don't Skulk. I'm going to, here's something to try. Mummy came up with the title of Come Now, Don't Sulk from, I didn't want to give it away, but I am going to give it away. No, I'm not going to give it away. I found that title in something, one of my favorite things has Come Now, Don't Sulk in it. And I'm not going to tell you what it is, but I'm going to ask you to call in with what you think it is. Some of you might already know, but I just, Come Now, Don't Sulk. And just see if you can figure out where that came from. And I think it'll make you chuckle. All right. So anyway, back to my announcements before we get going. Again, this is Come Now, Don't Sulk. It's a live podcast here on the Here Be Monsters Network, which is on Blog Talk Radio. So if you think of Here Be Monsters, that's the studio, the MGM studio, of which Mummy is a proud member. Gwendolyn Holdenberry is our Louis B. Mayer. And Blog Talk Radio is the movie industry. Does that make it sense? So that's where you've tuned in tonight. We are doing our last show before Halloween. This is the pre-Halloween show. And of course, we've got just a few days left before Election Day. So do keep that in mind as well. Many of you join me on SybilSez.com, SYBILSEZ.com, and SybilBrunchen.com. Please continue to do so. And for those of you that haven't friended me on Facebook or Twitter or whatever, please do so. Mummy is on all of those and Instagram. We've got a couple of things to talk about. I just got a message. By the way, you can private message me on my Facebook page if you're too shy to call in. The phone number I just was asked one more time, 323-784-9639. The show, I'm going to address this issue. the show is a free-for-all. It's a carte blanche. When Gwendolyn contacted me and said, would I like to do this show, and she was generously giving me this hour every Monday evening at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. And by the way, we're broadcasting live right now all around the world. Because it is a podcast, it is literally being picked up live in every country right now around the world. When she offered this to me, we talked about what should it be about. And we both sort of said, well, you know, in this amazing world we're in, why don't we make it carte blanche? Why don't we make it fun or political? Why don't we make it outspoken? Why don't we make it sentimental, nostalgic, cutting edge? It can be anything. And it really is up to my audience. And when you folks do not call in, then it's up to Mummy to figure it what out what the show should be based on what the world has been doing over the last 7 days and what you've written to me on Facebook or on my email addresses or anything. And some of you are very, very – some of you – first of all, some of you are adamant. Some of you are extreme nostalgia and sentimental people. You'd like me just to recite brownie recipes from the Betty Crocker cookbook. Others of you want me to literally give directions on how to make explosives. I must admit that I'm a bit of both. I am definitely – my politics are very out there. You all know where I stand on most issues. And you also know that I've created things like the Sybil Brunson's Lollipop Guild page on Facebook, which is only – about entertainment, fun, and funny posts, pictures of kittens, recipes, household hints, all sorts of things like that. I can go either way, and I am eager to do both of those things with you, my audience. I'm very eager to engage with you in any way you'd like. So call in and feel free to have at it, okay? I'm eager to engage in any way you would like tonight. While I'm waiting for a phone call, I'm going to address one thing we talked about last week. Gwendolyn Holdenberry is the proprietress and one of the creators of the DaughtersOfISIS.com company, which is a company that specializes in fragrances, essential oils, and products which awaken our sense of smell, but then our higher consciousness and our ability to reach broader and deeper parts of our emotions, our psychology, our spirituality through our senses. And last week we had a wonderful discussion about various fragrances that she had sent me, one of which I'm wearing tonight. And last week we addressed one of them, and we talked about what it was made up of and what it was used for, what its particular purpose was when she created it. And I'm going to ask Gwendolyn for another fragrance tonight that we can talk about for 5 or so minutes. By the way, I want to urge you, if you're on your computer tonight, to go to DaughtersOfISIS.com. They have wonderful products there. They've got a couple of hundred products there. They've got wonderful information there. Do check them out. And Gwendolyn, pick a fragrance tonight that you'd like to tell us about.
Well, you know, with everything that's been happening, my definite and Samhain approaching the way it is, which is the beginning of the new wheel of the year, which is all hollow, I would choose the dragon's blood, which is a spray. I created a formula to enhance dragon's blood resin, which is very protective. It creates a positive vibration, and it banishes the negativity in any given area or a person or a place or a thing. For thousands of years, the church has used dragon's blood as its main ingredient in its church incense to cleanse and purify. They also used it to make ink with it. A lot of the eldest texts, especially in the church, were written with dragon's blood ink. It was thought to be protective and always fastidious. So I created a
book. So when you opened it, when you opened a text of the churches, when you opened one of their huge parchment texts, it also smelled. It had a beautiful smell to it as well.
Yes, and dragon's blood itself, just the resin alone, has sort of a lemony sweet kind of scent, but it becomes very profuse, and it pervades everything in an area. The church.
And what is the origin of it? What is the origin of dragon's blood?
The old incense trail from the Middle East. It's the dragon tree. It's a resin from the tree of the dragon, and it
That's what I wanted you to explain to the home audience, because obviously it's not a real dragon, so I wanted you to explain what that actually means, because a lot of people don't know about the dragon tree per se.
Yeah, it's a red resin that bleeds out of the tree and is collected, much like frankincense tears and myrrh and copal. But what I do is I have created a blend to go with it, which is very earthy, and it has a top note of amber and agar wood, which creates a presence. It's a very popular scent. People really like it. But what it does is it chases negativity away. It creates a boundary and says, no, you may not come past this. And right now, folks are looking for anything to put the positive spin back into things. And if you're working with fragrance or scent, the dragon's blood is the best bet for it right now.
Well, I'm going to have to focus on that, because I was born in the year of the dragon. I've always had this strange affinity for dragons. And dragons as a force of good and a force of love, as opposed to a force of destruction. Although I must tell you, I must confess that even when dragons are very bad and they're very naughty in things like Harry Potter movies and in the Hobbit's fables, I find that even when dragons are extremely destructive, it rather amuses me. I'm sorry to say so. I've said it. I guess I just love their power. No matter which way it goes, I love the power and the majesty of dragons.
Well, dragons, of course, in Western culture represent the guardians of deep and vast treasures, and they're jealous of them, and they'll fight to keep them. But in Eastern culture, dragons are magnificent guardians who protect and bring prosperity and protect families. So
then dragon is the sign of the emperor. In the Chinese zodiac, the Asian zodiac, the dragon is actually the sign of the emperor, so it's considered to be a very hierarchical kind of sign of the 12. So, yes, that's true. That's very true.
So,
love that they guard their treasures.
Oh, they do. They're very jealous about the treasures. And a lot of Western spiritual culture these days employs the dragon energy and the dragon standard as a form of protection. So it's finding its transmutation in the new, the new age, basically.
Yep. And we are in a new age. I hope that this new age is going to be showing itself better and happier with this election cycle than it has been this past week. This past week, of course, has been a 1-2 punch to the national psyche, as I know you agree, Gwen, with the, first of all, the bombing, the mad bomber situation, which, thank goodness, none of them successfully exploded. No one was injured in any way. As terrible, as truly terrible as the synagogue shooting was, as the second of the 1-2 punch, 12 people is an appalling loss of life, but is not even close to what could have happened if all of those bombs sent across the country had gone off with their targets. I mean, not only the Obamas at their dinner table, but any guests that might have been there, people in the front yard of Joe Biden's house, Robert De Niro entertaining friends in his office. The list goes on and on, plus just collateral people walking by, people that had nothing to do with it, mad bombers, bombing terrorists. I never understand how they're targeting who they are. The world is so homogenized now. There are so many people in so many different places. How do you set a bomb so that it kills only your adversaries and your enemies and doesn't pick off someone that might be completely in sympathy to your political leanings? It's an act of irrational terror. It's not even like a sniper targeting specific people. It's just insanity. And I guess we need to be grateful for two things. First of all, that he was not successful. And that secondly, the shooter, though successful, was not more successful, so to speak, and didn't kill 50 people inside the synagogue. And of course, the one thing that I'm most grateful for, and I was desperate when I heard about the bombing, the bombs being sent everywhere. I begged the universe that this would not turn out to be a Latino person or a Muslim person or a left-wing person. I begged that this would be some lunatic, in fact, on the right, a white supremacist person of some sort who would be a right-wing person, and that this, the false flag thing was agony for me. I was out of town, and I was in agony over the false flag thing. I happened to be in Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, on work, and I watched the news every morning in the hotel restaurant, and we were all on the edge of our seats when the false flag theory came up. We were desperate. People were like, oh, my God, please, please don't let this turn out to be someone on the left trying to frame, you know, Donald Trump and his supporters. Please don't let it be that. And of course, as it turned out, it wasn't, despite the, you know, Fox Network's prevarications saying that it really is still a conspiracy and that the stickers on the van windows were too new, blah, blah, blah. Then this right-wing shooter, I can't believe it. Not only is he a right-wing person, a white supremacist, a fanatic of the Christian faith, he is to the right of Donald Trump. He actually is farther right than Donald Trump. So I was so relieved that, in fact, the lunacy and the lunatics were, in fact, truth in advertising, as we used to say in Ivory Soap. Truth in advertising. They were what they aspired and pretended and announced themselves to be. They were, in fact, they did really hate Robert De Niro. They really did hate Jews. They really did want to blow up they wanted to shoot everyone during a bris of all things in a synagogue. My dear God, thank goodness there were no children injured or the infant. It's just like, other than the circumcision, which I I think is injury enough, if you must ask me. But I find these things absolutely electrifying. This whole week has been astounding news items, exhausting. And when I hear that 28% of eligible millennials and university students are still not voting, 28% are. 28% of them are voting. It's the remaining 72% that are apathetic, uninterested, or not curious enough to care about the issues. When I hear that, and after this week, when everything has become clearer and clearer, I'm stunned, absolutely stunned. What were you going to say?
I don't believe it. I don't believe it. And you know, this guy who got his guns together went to the temple and wreaked havoc. He did so because he was urged with his mania, because he was listening to a lot of people on Fox News and at rallies talk about how there were Middle Easterners and how George Soros had, with all of his Jewish money, had backed all of these people.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Well, George Soros has become the Rothschild of the 21st century. There's always been these conspiracies about, you know, vast billionaires pulling the strings of governments and being in charge of the universe. And in fact, just all wars are actually plays. They're fictional plays being put on to keep the masses in line and to keep the masses distracted from the truth. In fact, you know, the old Rothschilds conspiracy was that the Rothschilds and other secretive millionaire billionaires at the turn of the century were in charge of everything, and wars meant nothing. Wars weren't about real issues at all. They were just exchanges of money and populations of fatalities. It's interesting. It's a hypnotic theory, but it's unlikely. I just don't think that it's likely, and I don't believe that George Soros is a dark energy. I think that the dark energies in our country right now are saying and showing themselves to be completely dark. They're right out there in the open. They're living in the White House. They're running the Senate and the Congress. We know who's dark. We know who's evil. We know who's crazy. We know who is in charge of the money and getting more money. And it certainly is not a philanthropist like George Soros. You know, I refuse to feel that he's the enemy. I'm sorry. I just don't.
Right. Agreed.
People are, it's what Katie says in the Way We Were, people are their principles. I'm sorry. I really do believe that. And I know that that separates some people from, it separates people from the big love-in that we're all supposed to be having. But people are so when people are, quote, nice, unquote, but they believe and espouse and enable and support things that are evil or terrible, they are not nice. Smiling people are not necessarily nice people. There were nice Germans who could smell the ovens 2 miles away. They knew what was going on. And even when the American troops came in and confronted suburbanites in Germany and said, what did you think what did you think those freight cars were carrying, and where were they going, and the factories with the chimneys going, did you really not know? And Germans were saying, we just were trying to get along, we're just nice Germans. You were not nice Germans. You were not nice Germans. And this country is full of not nice Americans right now. This country is the age of civility, quote unquote, ended. In my opinion, it ended on Inauguration Day in 2017, because that was the last day that civil and polite and sophisticated and educated Barack Obama and his family left. They were totally immersed in civility, and you saw how they were thwarted at every turn from the first day he was in office to the last by people who refused to do anything that he wanted to do for this country. He basically rescued the country from an appalling financial collapse brought on by the Republicans and Wall Street, and then was thwarted at everything that he attempted to do for 8 years. And they talk about civility. That bitch McConnell talks about civility in a restaurant with that Stepford wife / Fu Manchu's daughter, they go to a diner, and then people turn on them and confront them about Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, and that's uncivil. You people on the left, and I'm addressing my own fraternity sorority right now, because I don't give a damn what Fox thinks about civility. Laura Ingraham and her Siamese twin, Ann Coulter, you know, I have nothing to say about them. But when I hear people on the left go, well, we should try to remain civil when Mitch McConnell goes to a diner. Mitch McConnell, okay, in a diner is like Marie Antoinette wandering around in a street side cafe in 1789. What on earth would she expect? What would Nicholas Romanoff and that Alexandra wife of his expect trolling around in the back alleys of Moscow in 1917 looking for a cappuccino and a croissant? So if bitch McConnell is too stupid with his Kentucky background to know not to wander out into a diner with his wife, easily recognize the two of them as if any married couple in America looks at all like them, right? And wanders out, and a diner full of working class people turn on him and say, why are you wiping out our Social Security, our Medicare and Medicaid to line your pockets further? You and your one percenter GOP thug gang that have already given yourself tax breaks that are making you unbelievably wealthy, and now you're raiding? Why don't you raid the Pentagon, your playpen? Why don't you raid the military? You're raiding working people's Social Security to pay for your own stuff? In a civilized country, he would have been taken out and dunked into the French fryer alive. If Americans were really civilized, they would have torn him to pieces and fed him to the dogs. But no, we're still a nation of enablers. We still shuffle our feet and sort of hope for the best. We're hoping. I just got to hope for the best. The day of hoping for the best is over. Over. These people have no regard for working people. None. The middle class has continued to be squished lower and lower, and it is not by illegal aliens. And by the way, I'm going to address that right now. I live in New York, and I have traveled all over the country. Living in New York, I have more exposure to minorities and people of color and people from other parts of the world. New York City, English is one of 58 languages spoken now in New York City, okay? When you go to, maybe if you go to Butt Poke, Idaho, you might find less Muslims there or less Latino people, but you still are going to find them. But this is the bottom line. I don't know how it is for the rest of you in this country, but when I encounter Latin people in either New York or in various parts of the country, they are among the hardest working people I have ever seen. Their sense of meticulousness and their concern that they have served you the coffee properly, vacuumed your room beautifully, anything you encounter them in this city, any level of work from banking on down to housekeeping, whatever they do, they seem to be absolutely obsessed with being excellent. And by the way, always have been. I have never encountered this. The cliche of the Mexican sort of sombrero wearing, you know, that American cliche from Rifleman or from Wagon Train or whatever, of a Mexican being a lazy sort of shuffling. No. The real Latins in this country, the real Latino people, are extremely hardworking, and I have worked beside many of them and been stunned at their dedication, stunned. And that's another thing I want to bring up right now, America and its education. Let's just call a spade a spade, shall we, folks? Let's just call a spade a spade. Most Americans think of the Rio Grande as the beginning of Spain. They don't know the difference between El Salvador and Portugal and Brazil and Tierra del Fuego. It's all just Puerto Rico to them. It's all just Mexico to them. They don't know that Brazil is Portuguese and that Portugal is a separate country from Spain. Most of them don't even know that Spain isn't even a country in the Americas. They think it's down there somewhere beside Ecuador or Paraguay. The Americans have no curiosity and have no interest in what is really down there. The Latino people from Mexico on down consider themselves as different from each other as the Europeans consider themselves different. English people do not think they are at all like Germany and England are two different places. America and France are two different places. Well, wake up, butt poke America, because people in Latin America are as profoundly aware of the difference between Colombia and Nicaragua. Those are totally different places with different histories and different cultures, completely different foods, different nuances in their languages. So it's time that America crack open a geography book in third grade and start to learn that the earth is not flat. Okay. One of my favorite people in the world was chuckling with me just this morning and said, Sybil, if the world was really flat, cats would have pushed all of the objects in the world off the edge by now. I thought that was so charming. Being a cat lover, I just thought that was the most charming thing in the world. Yeah, if the world really was flat, cats would have pushed everything off the edge long ago. Okay, it's time that America start to catch up to the 21st century. And I would say that about 40% of us are still living in 1492. Okay, I see we still don't have any messages. I don't know. Maybe I scare everyone off when I go on these rants. I try to do this in the hopes that someone will come in with a brownie recipe, but no one ever wants to. We don't have a call yet, do we?
Not yet, Mommy.
Okay. I'm going to go to a happier subject because I think that we're going to let the wheels of justice deal with our mad bomber and with our shooter. By the way, I was asked again if I I did get a private message. Sybil, do you think that the shooter should get the death penalty since he's being considered for it? I think absolutely not. I think that I do believe, unfortunately, unlike the Constitution, in cruel and unusual punishment. I do believe in that. But I believe that death is not a punishment. We all are going to die, and most of us are going to die rather horribly anyway, you know, prolonged illness or, you know, a terrible accident or something. Death is not a punishment. Death comes for everybody. I think the worst punishment of all for someone who commits appalling crimes is to be imprisoned under horrible circumstances, and that their lives become forfeit to the state in the sense that they should be sentenced to hard labor, and then they should be paid 50 cents an hour, which is then paid to the state. And I also believe in excellent medical care for them. I think they should be kept alive at all costs so that they can fully appreciate the miserableness of being housed with their own kind, with very mediocre food. There should be no television. I don't understand why there's television. There should be no television. They should be, you know, they should literally be kept alive to reflect on a life of nothing, nothing. And so I don't agree with the death penalty under any circumstances. I did for years, and then I realized that having lost most of my friends to the AIDS crisis, and most of them died horribly, I was watching and I thought, well, why? Why would death be a terrible punishment? Death is a release. It's moving them on. No, I think that they should be left here. Bernie Madoff in that gorgeous prison cell of his, he's in a white, it looks like something out of the Paramount Hotel. It's like he's staying in Amsterdam in a luxury hotel. It's a white enameled and stainless steel immaculate train berth is what it's like. He should live in his own filth. He should take a shit in the middle of the floor every day for a week, and at the end of the week, someone should come with a garden hose and rinse it down the drain, and that's it. He should be living in absolute shocking squalor. His food should be served beside his latrine, and on the floor, and that's what he should live with. He's living better than some of the people that he ruined. They're third grade teachers that were wiped out financially. They weren't millionaires. They were people that had put money away in credit unions that were wiped out by him. Yeah. And he's put in white. There should be no white collar prisons, by the way. There's no such thing as white collar prison. You should be put into hell. That's what prison should be. Prison should be hell. And, you know, there are no gradations of hell. I suppose we wouldn't put a pickpocket in with a cannibal. Certainly not. I certainly don't think that marijuana offenses are things that are punishable in prison. It's selling marijuana. I mean, this should be legalized and that should be over with. That's a nonsense crime. But these crimes like shooting people in a synagogue, Dylan Roof. What was the name? The kid in Mississippi that killed all the African Americans in church. He shouldn't be executed.
No.
He should not be executed. He should be put into a filthy prison cell. And he should be forced to live with nothing. 60 years of living with nothing. Now, that's what I call instructive. That's educational. Okay? All right. Now I got off track again. Oh, by the way, I got a message from someone saying, Mommy, how has Halloween changed over the years? Can you talk to us about what Halloween was like when you were a child? Well, darling, when Mommy was a child and Halloween was celebrated, sadly, in Plymouth, which is right near where I lived, many of my neighbors were killed either by being hanged, crushed with stones, or burned at the stake. Halloweens when I was a child were somewhat grim, although there was trick-or-treating, and it was a different way of celebrating Halloween, and Mummy would go out in her witch costume and would actually have to run away from villagers. The one thing that was around back then, which is still around today, which is incredible, is candy corn, which was just as poisonous back then and tasteless and vile as it is today. And I am still convinced that some of the candy corn you can find in a Schraff's aisle at Duane Reade dates from 1620 and, in fact, was made back in 1620, perhaps as a conspiracy by the Dutch to poison the British or something when they took over New Amsterdam. I don't know. But I must tell you, the candy corn, I'm sure, has not been manufactured for at least 250 years. It's mostly fossilized, and it's just as deadly as it was when it was, quote unquote, fresh. So that's what Halloweens were like when I was a child. Yes, today, amazingly, and I did put this on Facebook, is the 6th anniversary of Hurricane Sandy. And Hurricane Sandy, of course, caused not only the blackout here in New York, a tremendous blackout, but it also canceled Halloween that year. Halloween basically didn't happen because the destruction was so bad. So up here, Halloween was basically gone, and it was an extraordinary experience. I actually was on Fire Island that weekend, and I was closing up the house, as I was yesterday, our little house out there. And it started out as beautiful weather, and then, of course, the forecast from that famous Weather Channel hysteric, Jim Cantore, got more and more severe, and for once he wasn't exaggerating. And Hurricane Sandy moved up the coast and then got worse and worse and really did hit the Northeast. And I was on the last boat out of Cherry Grove that afternoon. We had to get off the island. I've been in some windy weather out there. For those of you that know Fire Island and the Pines and the Grove and all the other towns, yes, water was washing up over the pier completely. The tide was extremely high. You were wandering down the pier in your waders because there was no way to wear sneakers. The waves were crashing over it. And when the ferry came ashore, it came up to the pier. It came up on the other side of the pier because the wind was blowing so badly. They didn't want it crashing into the pier. So they docked it. It was a masterpiece of navigation. It was like the most beautifully executed waltz I've ever seen. The boat came ashore. It was way up out of the water, so far up that they had to pull out the special ramps that lead up to it, like a Noah's Ark. And they put those down, the heavy aluminum and reinforced girder ramps. And we climbed up that, and we had to be helped up that ramp because it was at such an angle that you would have slipped and fallen with your stuff. So the young people from Stein Ferries were standing on either side and serving as banisters, helping us lift people up into the boat. We took off. It was the last boat off. People had been warned, and if they were still on Fire Island in any of those towns, they were going to have to stay there on their own responsibility and recognizance. They were going to have to, if they had insisted on staying in their homes, that's where they were going to stay. And, of course, I got back to Sayville. The parking lot and the whole dock area was flooded, and I got into an Uber and made my way back to the city and got in the front door. And this is when I was still living in the village, and I was on the 11th floor on the corner of Washington and West 10th in the beautiful Shepherd Building. We had a wonderful apartment there with an airplane view of the entire city. You know, when you're that high up, 11 stories is not high, but in the extreme West Village, it's like being on the 53rd floor, anywhere else. I could see everything from 55th Street, West 55th Street, across over to the Chrysler Building, over to the Empire State Building, down the whole length of Manhattan to the village, the East Village across from me. I could see the Con Ed Building in the distance all the way across over on the east side. Then I could look down and see to the Manhattan Bridge and the Brooklyn Bridge, and then on down to the new World Trade Center, the Freedom Tower going up. Our view was spectacular. If we had had just one more window in our bedroom, we would have been able to see the Statue of Liberty as well. So that gives you an idea of the panorama. I was standing at the window watching the storm go. The lightning was flashing. The wind was pounding. The rain was falling. My George was in the bedroom watching TV there, and I was in the living room watching TV and listening to the reports. I love storms. I'm never afraid in storms, and I've been in several. And I was just mesmerized by it. And at one point, the lightning flashed in a very strange way in the eastern sky. The whole city was spread out below me. lights everywhere, just gorgeous. I've posted those photographs from my view there many times, daytime, nighttime, summer or snow, all of it. And there was a weird flash of lightning that was bluer than the others. And then there was more flashes all over on the east side near the Con Ed Tower. And then amazing, spectacular, heartbreaking, and terrifying all at once, there was a shadow at the foot of the Con Ed Tower, which then began to march towards me as one block after another of Manhattan, lower Manhattan, blacked out. And the blackout literally marched towards me, and I had just enough time to say to George, "Oh my God," when our own lights went out. The lights went out all the way up to the Empire State Building. North of that, there were still lights on, but all to the south of me, all to the south was black. And I think if I remember correctly, there were a couple of buildings to the south that still had lights, individual buildings, but because they had emergency generators for some reason, either they were government buildings or some sort of arrangement where a couple of buildings had temporary light because they had backup generators that would keep them from blacking out for whatever reason. And there were only, but there were only a few, because the entire southern part of Manhattan was black. Everything went black down there. And we were in the blackness. And of course, on the 11th floor, that means you can't flush your toilet. So, you know, I think it's, what is it, three floors? Higher than three floors, there's not enough water pressure to service your plumbing and certainly your toilet. So I immediately said, okay, quick, fill the bathtub, fill jugs, fill anything we can with water. And we were doing that. And, you know, our refrigerator, of course, was off. Everything was off. I had gas, but you can't get gas going in an oven or a stove because the electric automatically shuts off. In the old days, you could still light your own oven because the gas would be there, provided there was still gas pressure. But I knew that everything was going, and we basically had to move north to Central Park West and 85th Street to a great friend of ours who offered to put us up, and we walked, by the way. We had to walk most of the way because it was, you know, you couldn't get cabs downtown. And over the next few days, it was truly a shutdown, truly a shutdown. And it was funny how our friends to the north knew there'd been a blackout, but they didn't put it together really so much because they weren't suffering themselves. And it was like, oh, really? Is Brooklyn blacked out? Is Far Rockaway blacked out? Is the lower Manhattan blacked out? And they couldn't grasp it. And even when they would see it on the news, they'd see the tremendous damage Sandy had done, and the death toll. They heard the death toll in Staten Island and in Brooklyn, and they still didn't quite get it. They still didn't quite get it. It's interesting. But that's my anniversary, and there's so many more stories I could tell you about that, but I don't want to bore you with that. Still no phone calls. I can't believe it. The Sears bankruptcy, I just want to address that. Sears is going bankrupt, and they're going to take JCPenney with them or whatever. I don't know. In all my travels, I've gone to, 15 states now and over the last 3 months. I've been in small towns. I've been in farm towns. I've been in big cities. Everyone has a mall. Everyone has a mall. Every city and village has a mall within 10 miles of it, 25 at the most. This was the great American capitalist dream of the 1970s. Malls were being built all over the place. Some cities were even earlier in the 60s. What was it? Elyria, Ohio, built a gigantic mall for Cleveland. And that was one of the first malls ever built. And that was in like 1960-something. But the 70s would be the decade of the malls. And the 80s continued. And this was America's it was yet another lie America told itself. Malls were places where corporate, international and national corporations could put up chain stores and eliminate the need for the mom and pops in small villages and storefronts. And that's exactly what happened. Mom and pop stores and little towns and little villages with main streets and cafes and bookstores and little hair salons, they all were erased. Everything was erased for the almighty, you know, all-white dream of malls just 10 to 25 miles out the city. Entire acres of farmland were fertile farmland were bulldozed down and turned into these vast all the same, all the look-alike giant malls with endless parking lots, burning endless amounts of petroleum, of gasoline, getting people to drive to and from them. There was no more walking culture. There was no more going downtown to see a movie at the local movie house after you've gotten your hair done at the salon next door and gone for breakfast at the diner. Did none of that exist? That all was erased for the all-knowing and American dream of the mall. And look what happened. Malls now are notorious failures. They are vast, vast plains of tumbleweeds rolling across blacktops that have cracked open full of weeds and detritus. You have wrecked cars, burnt out cars on some of these things. You have malls that are malls at best are being used as housing for SROs for homeless people, as shelters for mentally handicapped people, drug addicted people. This is the best use of, this is the ones that are actually being used successfully. Most of them are ghost towns, broken open, half arsoned away, burned away. They're shooting galleries either for drugs or for bullets. They are crime centers, ruined things of cement, non-recyclable material, material that cannot be recycled or will not decay back into the earth. These are made of steel and plastic and plaster and glass. These are vast ruins. And amazingly, their lifespan was what? 30 years. 30 years. Billions of dollars spent on these faux cities. These make-believe cities and centers of commerce, they lasted 30 years and now are in ruins. Municipal areas that are saddled with this crap, and by the way, didn't get their towns back either. So the towns didn't grow back after they were erased by Walmart and, you know, Kresge's and what are all of them? All of those corporations. They didn't grow back. The city, the town, little towns didn't come back. They're gone, and this has been replaced now. So I just want to say that Sears going bankrupt, for me, I'm sorry for the employees of Sears, just as I'm sorry for the people who work at Walmart, the hundreds of thousands of people that work at Walmart who can't afford to go shopping at Walmart. There's a lesson right there. There's a metaphor for our time and a message. But Sears going bankrupt, for me, is one of those moments where you go, uh-huh, and you nod, and you wipe away your almost tear from your right eye, and you say, well, karma, right? Karma. It sort of is divine justice. It's kind of a weird way of divine justice. And the sooner that Mother Nature can grow her blessed carpet of grass and weeds and wildflowers and dandelions and oak trees over the carcasses of those damnable malls and swallow them up under a wonderful carpet of stuff so that it vanishes, the better it will be, because that is one of America's biggest failure stories, the great mauling of America. And I use the word mauling as a double entendre. It is totally the mauling of America and what a mess that became. I've seen them in every place I've been. I've driven by them. I've driven through them. I've driven around them to get to something that might be charming, like an antique shop or a museum. And every city has got a sad loser mall in it, at least one. And the bigger cities have several. So, all right, we're running out of time. This turned into a total political show. How could it not, I suppose? Oh, one of you wrote in to me and said, misophonia. Mummy, do you suffer from misophonia? I am a longtime sufferer of misophonia, and we will address that the next time we do a show. I'm not going to tell you what it means. I'm going to let you guess, but I'm going to spell it for you so you can look it up, because Mummy likes you to look up words, just like Auntie Mae asked Patrick to look up words. Misophonia, M as in mother, I, S as in Sam, O, P-H-O-N-I-A. Misophonia, look it up. And call in next week so that we can talk about your misophonia experiences. I'll be very interested to hear what you consider to be your misophonia Achilles heel. There's a hint for you. What is the Achilles heel in your misophonia experience? I have several. I admit that I'm a bit neurotic. What else do we have? Somebody said, Mummy, have you started feeding, now that you're back in New York, are you going to go to Strauss Park, just north of you, just a couple of blocks north of you, and feed the birds? I have something I want to tell you all. This is a happy story. So last winter and every winter before, you know that I feed the birds. I go out and I feed my sparrows and my grackles and my pigeons and everything. And I joke about them and I tell stories about them and I show you what I feed them. I feed them an assortment of bird foods and seeds and crackers and all sorts of stuff. Anyway, to make a long story short, as the spring progressed and the weather got warmer, my diners became fewer. And I didn't blame them. I was a little heartbroken. But after all, things were beginning to bloom and there were seeds and there was food around for them and the weather was getting warmer and they weren't like operating on a frantic winter diet and metabolism. Little birds, I mean, if they don't eat every six minutes, I mean, they die because their metabolisms, their hearts are beating like 200 beats a minute and they've got to keep fueling their little furnaces or they'll die. By springtime, everything eases up, and they became less desperate. But as you know, and I've shown you in filmettes and my little tourettes, the birds would literally fly at me, fly up to me and on me and at me as far as a block away from Strauss Park. They'd spot me at my front door and begin leaving the park and fluttering towards me, much to the delight, amazement, or fear of my neighbors who would be walking with me and say, "What's happening? What's happening?" I would say, "Well, I'm the Tippi Hedren of the Upper West Side." I mean, you know, just the birds. And they would collect around me and they would be hopping around and chirping and what I assume is bird language for laughing, celebrating, applauding me. I mean, they were just, and I would feed them and they were just wonderful. So that eased up as April came and then May. By June, they would come in and be perfunctory and visit me, but that would be it. And then the summer went by, and I basically only fed them maybe three times, and only I would go and feed them like a special treat, like sunflowers and an apricot brioche or something, and they would go nuts. But for the most part, the hordes did not come at me. This is what's so funny. I figured they had all forgotten me. So I have not been out feeding the birds lately because I've been traveling so much. So as the weather got colder, I didn't get to feed them at all. Well, three days ago, we had just gotten back to New York, and we had just gotten there, and I went to Garden of Eden store, which is my grocery store, and I thought, you know, and I had a croissant with me, and this is a killer. I hadn't taken out of the bag. I had a cup of coffee and a croissant, and I was walking by the park, and suddenly sparrows were all over me. They were diving at my feet, looking up at me, tipping their heads, fluttering their wings, chirping and everything. And I looked down and I thought, what is going on? And I looked around. No, they weren't everywhere. They were just around me. It was like 6-foot radius around me. And I thought, you little fuckers, you have that much memory in a brain that's smaller than the thimble. Bird-brained, you are bird-brilliant. You could remember Mummy and the cold weather is here, and you thought, oh, there she is. I'm going to go get her. They were at my feet. I was walking a little bit. I slowed my pace, but they were barely getting out of my way. They were determined. They knew exactly who I was, right? And I thought, oh, I don't believe it. I just don't believe it. They had remembered me, and they had remembered me through all of summer and even into the fall. I thought, well, thank God I've got a croissant with me. I crumpled open my bag. The crumpling alone brought some pigeons because they're the Republicans of the park. And I pulled out the croissant. Well, then it was Wall Street. Then it was Grackles. Everyone had come over. Mummy's back. I felt like Dolly Levi at the Harmonia Gardens restaurant when the waiters start singing Hello, Dolly. It was like, oh, for heaven's sakes. I started breaking the croissant up and tossing it. The birds were absolutely everywhere. Pigeons came in. It was so funny. So I went out today again, and I took some bird seed, and they came right for me. not at my front door here, but halfway down the block, they spotted me and started fluttering at me. They came, and I know they're coming for me because they dive bomb me. What they do is they fly right at, I'm not frightened of them. They fly right at your face, and then when they're about 3 feet from your face, they veer up to the left or the right and then swoop around and land. But they're sort of welcoming you as much as they can hug you. It's kind of like an aerial hug. They spread their wings and fly right at you, and then they joyously sort of veer off to the left or the right, the bottom or the top, and then they swoop around and come right down and land at your feet. And it's sort of their way of greeting you, I guess. And it's so wonderful. It's something to, you know, shooters and bombers and losers and presidents who think that it's appropriate for them to go console the people in Pittsburgh when they have no business going there at all. Mitch McConnell wandering into a diner like an idiot when he should be used as a pinata until poops or candy come out. In a world of all that, my sparrows, my grackles, and even the dumbass pigeons coming and asking for treats is endlessly amusing and rewarding to me. As much as growing my orchids and my fern and my cycads. Oh, and my gardenia. I brought my gardenia home from the garden, and I boarded up my house and I closed up my garden and said goodbye. I am filled with gratitude, with poignant gratitude, sad and happy at the same time, laughing with tears coming down my face. I'm filled with all of those emotions during this time, and so I'm easy to please. Sparrows and grackles and pigeons and orchids and all sorts of stuff. I say thank you all the time. I hope you can find places to say thank you too. I think if you love somebody, you should say thank you and love them immediately. Tonight, do it all the time. We live in a very insecure and unsure world. We never know when someone's going to go to, the synagogue or to to a movie theater and not come back. I think we need to really bracket and frame every moment of beauty and love in our lives and cherish it and smell wonderful things like essential oils from ISIS, daughtersofisis.com, my wonderful sponsor. Gwendolyn, spread the love through fragrances, and we've got to do more and more and more of that to chase away the uncivility in our lives. And to really welcome in sophistication and civilization and broader love and acceptance and everything. Don't you?
Yes, I do. I agree with you. It's part of my job.
Our year is coming to an end. And I am already saying my New Year's thank yous. And one of my biggest triumphs this year was to be able to get to know Gwendolyn and to work with her on this show. Just as I was writing for the newspapers out on Fire Island, Shoshana, thank you. Thank you to all my listeners every week. I can't tell you how much I look forward to being on Monday nights and to talking to people not only a block away from me, but a hemisphere away from me. Oh, brave new world that has such people in it. It's wonderful. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And there's so much to be grateful for and so much to say, oh, this is gorgeous. This is beautiful. This is fun. This is funny. This is happy. This is a source of light and life and love. And it's all around us. And it doesn't mean that we have to enable or forgive or be okay with people that do not espouse those things. You can be a happy warrior, as Franklin Roosevelt and Al Smith said. You can be a joyous warrior against wrongdoing. You can be the person who is not okay with bullies, and you can wade into the playground of the world, and you can wage war against bullies, against victimizers, against tyrants, against molesters. And you can do it joyously and with a glad heart, knowing that you are championing the less strong, the just as worthy, the vulnerable, and other beings, not just people, beings that deserve to be loved. You go out and do that. Do that, okay? Sybil says. We are coming to a close. I want to remind you this was Come Now, Don't Sulk. We're on Monday nights at 8 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, soon to be Eastern Standard Time. I love being with all of you. Please contact me on Facebook, friend me there, or on Twitter. And I'm going to say goodnight. Gwendolyn, thank you again to you and DaughtersOfIsis.com. I will see you next week. I love you.
I love you. Good night, Mommy.
Good night. Good night, everybody.
Good night.